On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Android hacks your network, we get up to 40G, HP gets back in the tablet game, and we got big data, baby. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 30, recorded February 25th, 2013. Big data gets personal. This episode of Twyatt is brought to you by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. And by GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix, the powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate with colleagues and clients from anywhere. You can share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing, even from an iPad. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use promo code ENTERPRISE. Welcome to Twyatt This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And as always, I am joined by a fantastic panel. This time, our number one member is Mr. Brian Chi from the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory, the evangelist for Thin Links. Brian, how are you in the beautiful paradise that is Geek Honolulu?
I'm doing fine, Father Robert. I'm not like the coyote behind me. Things are actually working, and I'm starting to take a dive into bringing up an OpenStack demo.
Nice. And I noticed that you're not 8-bit Chibert today. You don't seem to be breaking up nearly as much as you do when you come across the Pacific. So have you done something different to pamper your bits?
Yeah, I'm off the really old MacBook Pro that's got tons and tons and tons of stuff on it, and I'm outside the firewall, so I'm actually got a lot more bandwidth to play with, and I don't have any IPS trying to traffic shape me.
Nice, nice. Now, well, we've given Curtis Franklin and Oliver Rist a day off. They're actually spending the time connected to each other over Skype, and they're arguing over minutiae. So hopefully they'll be rested and ready to go next week. But let's get to it with the Enterprise Byte. The first Enterprise Byte is all about, well, pen testing. We've got a story out of Wired about a new, well, I'm going to say it the real way, which is OwnPad. Some people will call it the PwnPad. It's a Nexus 7 that runs AirCrack and Kismet. It allows handheld pen testing and uses a TP-Link wireless adapter, and they've hacked it to support packet injection, which is what makes air cracking possible. Now, they're selling this kit for $795, which is a significant premium. I mean, especially since the tablet itself goes for about $200 and the adapter can be had for about $50. So what you're really buying are the modifications that they made to make this a handheld penetration tester. Now, Chibert, tell me, why would I want something like this where I could buy a laptop for less than that and run all that software probably better than I could on the Nexus 7 platform?
You know, I don't know. I'd much rather run it on a laptop, and that way I can run 2.4 and 5.8 gigahertz. I'll bet you the price premium is so that they're starting a sinking fund to pay for their legal fees once someone starts suing them.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it is a pretty big price premium, and I understand why someone would like this. I would totally geek out over it, but I would geek out over it if I had made it, if I had taken my Nexus 7 and hacked it so that I could run, say, a packet injection Wi-Fi tool on it. Buying it seems kind of cheating, and it's not just cheating. It's also kind of silly cheating because, again, I could almost buy my premium Acer 7 laptop here. I could definitely buy a cheaper, sort of a $400 laptop and run all that software more quickly, more efficiently. So again, I think this is for the closet geek, the one who really wants to have the cool toy to show off at the next DEF CON.
Now, well, heck, I could do a Chromebook, for God's sakes, and put Ubuntu on it.
Right. Actually, yes, that would be much better. You could probably make the exact same setup for under $400, and it would run better. But hey, you know, you get bragging rights if you've got the tablet that can break into someone's network. Let's go into the second story. This is something that hits close to home, and that is 40 gigabit Ethernet ready? We've got a story out of HitBee talking about how they've done proof of concept to show how Category 8 Ethernet can do 40 gig networking. Now, Cheebert, we've both worked with different types of cable, different types of copper that have allowed up to 10 gigabit over copper. How big of a jump is it to go from 10 gigabit to 40 gigabit?
Well, everybody thinks that transmitting data over copper is magical. It's not. It's all about a concept called headroom. How easy can you tell the signal from the noise? Because keep in mind, if you run a chunk of copper wire and it's nice and straight, you just defined an antenna. So it's going to pick up all kinds of junk. So the engineers get around that by twisting it. Now, in the case of Category 8, I'm actually getting some serious deja vu here because that looks exactly like IBM Type 2 shielded twisted pair cable back in the token ring days. So Jason's got a link to it. You can actually see the shielded twisted pair cable. Yeah, there you go. Let's see if we can zoom in a little bit. Look at that. That is ultra-thick twisted pair cable. So it's 22 gauge instead of 24 gauge, which we're used to in Cat 5. And it's got foil wrapped around each pair and a drain wire and then a shield around the whole shooting match. That's going to be a real bummer to connectorize. It's also not going to be cheap. But in order to keep down the amount of noise that it pulls in from the air, it needs it. You really do.
Yeah. But, I mean, see, this has always been a question for me. And that is the big news is that they're designing this so it can use RJ45 connectors. So it's something that you've seen before. It's the same thing when we were working with 10 gig copper gear. They're designing to use RJ45, so there's some sort of familiarity. But that's where it ends because no one is going to mistake a Category 4 cable, Category 5 cable for a Category 8. You're not going to be able to run a Category 8 cable in a big bundle across your plant because they are so thick, because they are so stiff. So this really seems to be something that you would design for interconnects, which begs the question, why do you need to design RJ45 if all it's going to be used for is interconnecting between boxes inside of a rack?
Yeah, and, you know, fiber's not expensive. You know, I don't know why. Exactly. You know, people get all hung up. Oh, copper is so much cheaper. No, it's not. I mean, for God's sakes, you can buy an LC to LC patch cable from Monoprice, say a 3 meter. You can probably pick that up for like $7 now. That Category 8 cable to start off with, that's going to be a $50 cable for the same length.
Yeah. So why is it that they do this? Because we saw this with Category 6. And yeah, you can do it, but those Category 6 cables, again, we had big stacks of them and we used to hit each other with them. I mean, they're serious pieces of copper. Why would you do that rather than getting a much cheaper piece of fiber? I don't get it. I mean, can you explain
that to me? It's all
about
licensing. It's licensing. Yeah. Keep in mind, the LC connector, everybody that makes it has to pay a license fee to Lucent. That's all. That's what it comes down to. That's the reason why Token Ring didn't take off, even though in certain cases it's superior technology. It's because IBM demanded this huge license fee. Because Ethernet was developed by DARPA, well, it was a spin-off from a DARPA project called AlohaNet. The reality is you know, no fees. So as a result, you could sell Ethernet quite a bit cheaper than Token Ring. I think the same thing's going to happen in the world of fiber. We happen to really like the Volition VF45 system because it is dramatically cheaper and easier to connectorize than an LC. But they all have license fees.
Right. Now, Joel H. in the chat room makes a comment there. He says, punch down, question mark. And I think what he's asking is that why we like copper? Because we can terminate it ourselves. But again, T-Bert, we have experience with this. Could you describe quickly what the experience is like of trying to punch down Category 6?
Long nights, lots of finger slices, lots of finger smashes. Dents in my fingers trying to untwist the copper. The reality is I've actually done a Cat 6A. Cat 6A cable is very nearly the same as Category 8. The only difference is that it's got Category 8 has shielding around each pair. Category 6A cable takes me, and I'm pretty good at this, it takes me about 2.5 to 3 minutes per RJ45. A system like the Volition VF45, when I'm in the groove, I can do a duplex fiber optic connector with an angle polish. That means I can run 40 gig or 100 gig, no problem. And I can do one of those connectors in around 45 seconds. And the connectors are actually cheaper.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll see this evolve. I'm sure there's going to be some different type of technology that's going to be offered that is really going to be based for interconnects. Maybe something like what Google already has with their super secret hardware. But let's move on. We've got one last story in the Enterprise Byte, and that is, I don't have a soundboard for a really cool fanfare sound. HP is getting back in the tablet game. That's right. Just a bit after killing off what could have been an absolutely awesome Web OS tablet, HP has decided to get back in the game with a 7-inch Android tablet. Now, here are the specs. Android 4.1. It's got a 7-inch HFFS. That's a high aperture ratio field fringe switching screen. At 1024 by 600 resolution, it weighs 13 ounces, has a stainless steel frame, has an ARM dual-core Cortex A9 1.6 gigahertz processor. It leverages HP ePrint, which means that if you have an HP printer, you will be able to print easily from the tablet. Has 8 gigabytes of memory plus a micro SD card slot, 3-megapixel camera on the back, a VGA camera on the front, and here's the big thing, $169. So they've hit that magical below $200 price point. T-Bert, looking at the specs, you know, the resolution seems to be a bit low, but it looks like they're trying to recapture that Nexus 7 Lightning in a bottle. It's cheap, decently specced out. And, I mean, if you do have an HP printer, like many people do, you will be able to print directly from the tablet without having to install something like a Lantronics X-Print Serve or worry about AirPlay. What do you think about this?
I want one. You know, I like the stainless steel. I can see it as something that you could take around a construction site. I could see it taken around, you know, in a school. I could see it being used in a lot of industrial applications, which HP tends to be a lot better at vertical market than they are at general consumer items. I'm sure they're hoping that this catches on just like the Nexus 7 did. I think it's going to be a nice try, and I can't wait to get my hands on one.
Yeah, I've got a desire to get my hands on one. Lou MM in the chat room brings up a point that I think a lot of people are having in the back of their mind, and that is, is HP just too late to the game? I mean, this is not a new form factor. This is a form factor that's been around in the Android marketplace for a while. Nexus, ASUS really, really kicked it out of the park with the Nexus 7. Are they just trying to copy something else that someone else has already done? Or is this a new segment for HP? Because they don't have a great track record here.
No, I really think, I carry around my Nexus 7 in the cargo pockets of my shorts. But I have to put it in a case because it's not exactly the most durable system on the face of the earth. You know, you put cases around and things like that. But a metal case and, say, Gorilla, I don't know if it was Gorilla Glass 1 or Gorilla Glass 2, but especially if I put a film on that, I might be tempted just to drop it in my pocket without any of the bulky cases, which doubles the thickness of my Nexus 7.
Right, right. Well, I think we're all looking forward to see what this kind of competition will do. I definitely want to get my hands on one. I want to see how hackable it is. I want to see what the performance is like. HP could have a nice little niche item on their hands. We'll just have to wait and see. I do want to take a moment here to stop and welcome one of our sponsors, RingCentral. Now, when Leo built the brick house, he made a conscious decision to put as much as possible into the cloud. He wanted our meetings in the cloud. He wanted our calendars in the cloud. He wanted as much in the cloud as possible because, you know, Leo's a forward-looking guy and he wanted to eat his own dog food. If he was pushing his listeners to be in the cloud, he wanted Twit to do the same. So when our IT guy, Russell, told us that we could have our phone system in the cloud, well, we jumped at the chance. You see, having a internet-based, a cloud-based phone systems means that we can have PBX-type features without PBX hardware. We don't have to have a clunky box in the basement with wires snaking up through the floor. We don't have to have a dedicated IT guy who comes in just to reset extensions. We can do everything ourselves with one easy user interface. The RingCentral, it was a no-brainer because we love their zero startup costs. We love the fact that there's no PBX hardware to install and maintain. We love the fact that they allow us to customize all of our call handling. Our producers get their voicemail and their emails, and we can even get our fax messages on our phones. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing as low as $20 per month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. One more time for good luck, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, let's get to it. We've actually got a special guest, an add-on to our panel, Miss Valerie Williamson from Other Levels. Valerie, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Now, do you want to tell our audience a little bit about who you are and who you represent?
Yeah, I'm with Other Levels, and what we do is big data for the mobile messaging layer. So we have this mobile messaging intelligence platform that allows enterprises, mainly retailers, big brands, and other folks that have a mobile strategy to be able to leverage the big data to help them have a really kick-butt mobile strategy where they're not annoying their users, but they're leveraging the data in a smart and intelligent way to message to them appropriately at the right time, the right place, and the right language at the right location.
We had Andrew Brust on a while back, and he talked more about the general field of big data. And he talked about what it is and what it could be used for. What I'm hoping that you'll be able to give us and our listeners is a taste of how you actually apply it to a business plan, how someone in an enterprise, in a business, a small business, even a home business, can use big data on mobile to, well, do it, what it is that they do. Let's get right into it. So first of all, a recap. When we're talking about big data, we're really talking about the three Vs. This is sort of the traditional definition of what big data is, because big data doesn't just mean a ton of data. You need to have volume, which is that ton of data, but you also have to have velocity. You have to have a lot of data coming in, and you have to have a way to quickly process it, to do something with that data that turns it into usable information. And finally, there's variety, because anytime you're talking about big data, you want to be able to bring in that data from various sources, because if you're bringing it in from just one IO, then it's not really something that you can make correlations with because you're only looking at a single dimension. Now, what can we do about big data and why should we care about big data? This is something we covered a while back. I want to bring this article back from Wired Magazine. And they're talking about big data being important because it allows us to pull together disparate sources of information that can give us inside information that is useful. It looks at, for example, you could look at buying patterns and look at social media to determine whether or not someone is ready to buy something and then use that time to actually pitch. Valerie, I think this gets to your point about not annoying the customer with big data, but rather making it possible so that you can actually target just when that customer is ready to buy. Right.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, absolutely. I think that, you know, with big data, what people are... Can you hear me?
Yes.
Uh-oh. Well, okay, So while we dial her back, one of the points I wanted to make about big data is that it's actually a progression. Back in the days, we used to call that just straight old customer relations management. And whether people know it or not, they've been dealing with big data for an awful long time. If you walk into a typical grocery store like Safeway or Big Save or someone like that, you notice that the aisles get changed around an awful lot. It drives you crazy, but what they're doing is they're actually watching the buying patterns of their customers and trying to put the things that go together. So like dog food and diapers for some reason go together. Bake and serve rolls and dairy products go together. So that's been some of the early data mining. Now, what big data has done is it allows us to take dramatically more data, bring that in and correlate things so that we can find out what's going on.
Right. Well, Valerie, you're back. Yes.
Yeah, I'm here. I've been able to hear you guys the whole time. But I would say, first of all, to Brian's point, bacon goes with everything. But other than that, I would say, you know, Brian's absolutely right. And I think the big challenge and the big opportunity with big data is to really look at, it's all about relevancy. And when you're looking at this big data, how relevant is it to your customers? And that's what it's going to be able to do. You're going to really be able to look at that and say, am I liking bacon and ice cream? And if I like that, then what else would I be potentially buying when I'm in that store in that moment, not necessarily outside of that store and outside of that moment? So I think that relevancy becomes key when you're applying big data, whether you're an enterprise or a small business.
I like that. I think that's actually a really good way to look at big data. And that is, big data becomes useful when it helps us to increase our relevancy. Big data should not be used just so that we can spam more, but it should be used so that we can actually target useful services and useful products to people at the time that they're ready to use those products and services. But I do want to go into another story that is talking a bit about the dark side of big data. We've hinted about this on the program maybe once in a while. This is, again, a story from Wired that talks about big data allowing us to draw correlations that don't necessarily exist. The example that that I like to use is, I was playing with Hadoop a while back, and I was pulling in data from Twitter and from Facebook, basically any publicly scrapable data source. And I was able to make a direct correlation between those who post pictures of their meals and health problems. Now, that was kind of a funny correlation. And of course, we don't believe that everyone who posts a picture of their meal is going to have a heart attack. But you could use those data sets for example, if you were running a healthcare organization to raise the premiums of people who are posting pictures of their food on the internet. This seems to be a shadowy side of big data, which is it allows us to make connections that are not necessarily there depending on which data sets we're drawing from. Achievert, I want to throw this to you first. What risks do we have when the data sets we choose sort of bend the final outcome?
Well, I like to say you can make statistics support any theory. And if you don't ask the right questions, you're not going to get the right answers. So it's all part of good scientific methodology. Is your question valid, and can it be validated independently? I think that's one thing a lot of people keep forgetting.
Right. Valerie, over to you. One of the ways that people have in the past solved for this, try to get rid of the bias of data entry, is to say, look, the more data sets we have, the less biased the data outcome will actually be. So the fact that I pulled from just Twitter and Facebook meant that I was automatically biasing myself against people who posted pictures on the internet. How would you solve for something like that? I mean, if we're actually trying to target items to people, let's say I'm running a retail enterprise, how would I choose my data set so that I don't bias the final outcome?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think that, you know, first and foremost, you know, big data is not necessarily great data either, which is, I think, the point you're trying to make. And I believe that what people should be looking at is the behaviors of what their customers are doing when they're engaging with their product, right? And for example, I like to use this this particular case around Saks Fifth Avenue. I have the Saks Fifth Avenue app on my mobile phone. I love going to browse and shop, but I typically just look at boots. I don't really look at anything else. I don't look at men's clothing. I don't look at accessories. I usually go onto that app and I look at boots. And so that's very telling. I don't, now, if I just went to the Saks Fifth Avenue app and in one day I looked at 20 pairs of boots, that necessarily would not make me a boot buyer. And unfortunately, a lot of companies make that mistake and they think, oh, Valerie went on my app and on this day she looked at 20 pairs of boots. Therefore, I'm only going to surface up stuff about boots to her. Well, that would be leveraging the big data in the wrong way. The way to really leverage that data is to look at what I do over a period of time. Again, that relevancy. If I'm coming back and every time I come back to that app, I'm looking at boots, well, then maybe you should target me as a boot buyer. And maybe you should be communicating me and surfacing up my experience so that I will find the type of information and products that I am more predisposed to look for based on my behaviors. Again, getting back to that relevancy.
Right. I like that. I want to bring up the case of, AOL, you may remember this from 2006. This was before we called any of this big data. They actually released a big data set onto the internet. And what they had done is they had taken just logs. So what people were searching for, what they were doing, they stripped out the what they thought was the unique identifying information, put in a couple of random numbers for IDs, and then they released it and they said, okay, internet, what can you do with this? I think this was one of the very, very first uses of big data, and the world freaked out because it wasn't really anonymous. You could look at a data set and look at, say, the most recent searches, and someone who was constantly searching for a particular name, you could typically figure out that that was them. It's a vanity search. They're searching for themselves. So again, my question to you, Valerie, would be, how do you keep people from freaking out about this? Again, the AOL example was before we called it big data. It really was only one source of information, but it's the same sort of thing. It was a collection of information that they thought was anonymous, that they thought people could use in a useful way, and it ended up just spiking the ire of the public.
Right, right. And, you know, I think that right now it's a great question because I think privacy becomes this big concern for a lot of people. But at the end of the day, if you're a trusted brand or an enterprise or a business, then you need to be very careful with how you leverage the unique IDs of your users. And certainly when we talk more about mobile, there are ways to really do that. But I think if you're a trusted brand, people are going to trust you with their data. And you're seeing that more and more where people are opting in for certain things. Like you're now, especially when you're on a mobile app, a native app, you're able to opt in for a lot of things, which means I only want to be communicated to based on these particular likes and dislikes. So treat me as such and preserve my data in that way. If I only want to find out about the 49ers scores, don't send me scores from the Raiders because I don't really care about the Raiders. I told you all I care about is the 49ers. So give me that information about the 49ers. And people will find that, or brands and enterprises will find that the more that you do that, the more the consumer will trust you. So let them opt in for things. Let them tell you what their likes are. Let them show you, based on the behaviors that they take with your brand, the things that they're most interested in. And then be careful not to abuse their behaviors and abuse the data that you're collecting on them and leverage that and turn that around to spam them.
All right. Chibert, Magic Shoes in the chat room keeps saying the same thing, which is Hadoop excretes charts. We call it excrement. And that's actually kind of true. I mean, Hadoop is a great tool. It's a fantastic framework, but it's only going to spit out an analysis of what we put in. So same question over to you. And that is, how do we use disparate sets of data without completely freaking out the public about the data that we're collecting on them or that they're giving us?
I don't know. It's a heck of a good question. I just went through a whole lot of training to deal with very sensitive data, patient data for the National Institute of Health. And the amount of safeguards that those people put in place is staggering. It took me almost a full week to go through those training classes. And that's one of the things that they do, is they try to make sure that even the contractors that are supporting a National Institute of Health project has the training to make sure that they don't release confidential information. And the whole thing on PII, personal identity information, is pretty well formed when you start getting into the medical community. What people need to start thinking about doing, you know, especially retailers, is start thinking the same way as, say, make pretend you're a doctor and say, okay, what other things can be used to identify a person? You know, those vanity searches are a very good example. But someone that's going and doing a lot of searching, you might want to be very careful on how you do your correlations, because a lot of correlations can be very, very revealing, especially when you start dealing with, say, health issues or health products. It's something you need to be careful of, and I think we should probably take a page from the playbook for the National Institute of Health.
Web6437 in the chat room makes an interesting comment. He says, if you want people not to freak out, just don't tell them, which sounds funny, but that's actually a tack that many corporations, that many enterprises have taken. We're going to talk a little bit more about that, but first I want to take another break to talk about another one of our sponsors, that's Citrix with GoToMeeting. Now, we all know that successful teamwork is a foundation for a successful business. You need to meet with your colleagues, with your coworkers, with your managers, your subordinates, your team, in order to make sure that you're all on the same page. Now, and when you meet face-to-face, well, it makes all the difference, because it's that subtle body language, the frown or the smile or the raised eye, that really tells you what the other person is thinking. But with clients and coworkers spread out across the globe and on the go, coming together can be near impossible. That's why I use GoToMeeting with HD Faces, the powerful and simple way to meet and collaborate online, from wherever you are, whenever you need to connect. With GoToMeeting, it just takes a click to share your screen and work on documents in real time. And with a webcam, you can see everyone in HD video, which gives you that face-to-face experience. It's just like meeting in person. It's so easy to launch or join a meeting from anywhere using your computer, phone, or tablet. And now GoToMeeting even allows you to present from your iPad. Now, I like having Citrix as a sponsor because I use GoToMeeting on an almost daily basis. My work used to take me to the four corners of the globe on a weekly basis just to keep in touch with my colleagues. That's days, weeks, and months on the road, all while losing my sanity, my health, and the ability to connect with the people back at my office in D.C. GoToMeeting not only allowed me to keep in touch with my colleagues in the field without having to fly to their locations, but I would argue that our communication is now better than it has ever been because we can meet as often as we need to get the work done. I love GoToMeeting. It's so easy to use, and with HD Faces, it is just like meeting in person. So here's what I want you to do. Try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Don't wait. For this special offer, visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code ENTERPRISE. Be sure to use the promo code ENTERPRISE. GoToMeeting, meeting is believing. And we thank Citrix for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's get to the meat of the show. That's right, we're talking big data and mobile. Valerie, we brought you on specifically to talk about this. You are sort of the queen of mobile big data. And tell me, what is it about mobile that sort of, well, opens up the possibilities for what we can do with big data?
Right. Well, I think the most exciting thing that mobile does that's different than what people are used to with big data is that mobile opens up the possibility of understanding the user's specific location and also language preference. So, again, you know, Brian was talking about PIIs and user IDs and all of that. Well, with mobile and with big data, we're able to understand that information at an even more granular level, and that it that can be protected. And Brian's absolutely right that people should treat that PII like healthcare providers do when it comes to mobile, because there is that sensitivity around location and language. And that's the big difference with big data for mobile, is that now I can say, I know that, you know, we all know that Brian's in Hawaii right now, but now through his mobile device, I can tell which part of Hawaii he's in, which town he's in, which city block he's on, which retailer is he nearby. So now when you're leveraging and layering that big data on top of it, we can show by location if he's walking past a Starbucks. And if he is, should we send him an offer at that time, right, that says, hey, you're near a Starbucks, here's jump in for a free cup of coffee for every cup of coffee that you buy. And so those types of offers become, if the user is opted in for them, become very relevant and very useful and very timely. So those sort of things with, you know, that's the big difference that we can see with mobile, is that it's not only being able to track more accurately a user's particular behavior and segment those behaviors into different target audiences, but also layer on top of that location and language preference.
Right, right. Chibert, I want to cut over to you. And don't talk as a host for a moment, or don't talk as an IT person for a moment, but talk as a typical user. How do you feel that, you know, we can track you through your phone, that we do know where you are at all times, that we can correlate activity on your phone? Let's say you're looking up a particular product, or you're looking for a coffee shop, with where your physical location in the world is.
You know, maybe I'm a little strange, but I actually don't mind that much. You know, I one of the people in the chat room says, oh, they just love it when they get an ad for something they've just bought. Well, if I had some location information and say Sears knows that I just walked into the TV section, I think it would be actually kind of cool if someone popped up a ad saying, if I buy this brand or if I buy something today, I can get some free accessories, or I could get free installation or something like that. I think that's actually kind of cool, but I do want to be able to opt in for such things. One of the things that I'm actually kind of really interested in is to see what happens with Google Glass. Being able to have that and have this constantly popping up information as I walk down the street or I'm driving or something, or having the ability to know that that piece of Cyrillic signage means that that's a Kentucky Fried Chicken and maybe that's where I want to go. That kind of, I like that. You know, I'm a child of science fiction, and I think science fiction is becoming science fact a heck of a lot faster than I had thought it would. And I like that. I don't mind it. You know, Facebook, I don't put anything on Facebook that I don't want, that I wouldn't be willing to shout at a street corner at the top of my lungs. So as long as people make sure that what they put into the public is something they're willing to share, then maybe, just maybe, big data isn't going to be so bad after all, but maybe it's going to improve my quality of life.
That's right. That's right. And I would add to that that you mentioned something at the head of that, Brian, which is that it's the opt-in layer. And I think mobile does that better than the web than the native web does off of desktop, is it allows you with a native app to opt in. You know, it's very easy. The first thing that you get when you download an app is they want to understand your location, yes or no. You know, and if you're clicking yes, it's very easy to go in and switch that back to no, just like the same thing with push notifications. And I think that when you're looking at big data and you're looking again at that relevancy, and I'll hammer back on that word again, relevancy, it's so important. And Brian gives a great example with the Sears example. And, you know, that is something that's valuable to the consumer. I don't feel that that's scary in any way. It's actually valuable to the consumer to be able to get that offer in the right time, in the right place. What would be annoying to me is to walk out of that Sears and 2 days later get an offer for, you know, free accessories for that television. And that's what a web experience is like today when you have these behavioral targeted ads. I'll go to a website and I'll look at, you know, Ring Central, right? Or actually, I shouldn't say Ring Central. I'll say their competitor, 8x8. I'll go look at 8x8. But then all of a sudden, 8x8 ads will be following me for the next 10 days on all the websites I hit. That to me is annoying. Whereas, you know, the right time, the right place, and that relevancy is so important.
Right. Valerie, I want to ask you this because, again, your specific niche is big data with mobile.
Yes.
Does mobile give us more than just location data? Or is, when you speak of big data on mobile, is it just everything we've been accustomed to with big data plus the user's location at that particular time?
I think it's not only location, but I said earlier, language is another thing. You don't get that right now. You know, one can assume when I'm in France, if I go to a website, I'm going to get that experience in French, but I'm not a French speaker. With my mobile device, though, it understands that I'm English language, right? But it also understands that if someone is traveling from France and they're a French speaker, everything they're going to get on their mobile phone is French, right? Will be in their native language. So that's a big difference. The other thing is just more behavioral targeting, because again, the mobile device is very tied to that. It's that user device, that UDID. And I think that unique ID is very much tied to that user. So at other levels, what we like to say is, without knowing that Brian is Brian or Father Robert is Father Robert, we know what you're doing within that mobile app. And we can then better segment you so that we deliver more relevant messaging, more relevant offers, and allow the retailers to send you more relevant messaging, more relevant offers at the right time, in the right environment, and in the right language that you're looking for.
Right. HiWeb in the chat room brings up a good point that in the internet age, we've sort of become accustomed to giving up our location, giving up different bits of information. The typical traditional chat room welcome was always ASL, age, sex, and location. That was sort of the way to say hello. I guess when we have these sort of mobile devices, we are more accustomed to giving up more data than maybe we would if we were sitting behind our desktop. But I want to get back into that later. Right now, I want to take a tangent because there are a few comments in the chat room about, well, the usefulness of big data. Is it only to watch us? Is it only so that they can keep tabs and target us with a new ad for Boots? There is one specific example that was brought up today by the New York Times about how Netflix used big data to know that House of Cards would be a hit even before they started filming the first episode. Now, they get this from a GigaOm article a few days back that talked about the different things that Netflix gets each and every single day for their subscribers. They got 25 million subscribers. They get 30 million plays a day. They get 4 million ratings. They get 2 billion hours of streamed video per quarter. And they get all of the information about the time of day that particular videos were played, whether or not someone fast-forwarded or rewinded or paused within a video, when video plays were abandoned, meaning that people just they got fed up and they went to something else. Netflix has been able to collect all this data and then we'll crunch it, basically make a Venn diagram that showed what people wanted. They baked that into House of Cards. Now, Valerie, my question to you is, this seems to be an advanced use of big data. Is this the way to use it, the proper way to use it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that what they're doing is they're making business decisions based on that, and they're giving their subscribers something that they know just based on their behaviors that they're going to like and enjoy. So, you know, you're reducing the risk at that point. And I think that is a great example of big data being used in the right way. They didn't come out and say, hey, Brian and Robert like Kevin Spacey movies, so therefore we're just going to target them. They compiled all of this information based on what their entire base of subscribers were doing and all of that data to come up to make a very strong, wise business decision and then target it out to them. And then what I love most about that article, Father Robert, that they did is they also took that and then they leveraged that data and they leveraged that information to then be able to target and market House of Cards in the right way. Again, they were able to say, hey, here's all these Kevin Spacey fans. So we're going to do a separate trailer that really features Kevin Spacey out to these people that are maybe going to download and stream The Usual Suspects, or maybe going to download and stream, you know, one of the other shows that he's been on. So they leveraged that data to not only make a strong business decision as to what content they were going to produce and stream, but also how they were going to market that. Again, relevancy.
Right, right. Chibert, we've got a comment in the chat room from Darth Packet, who says, oh my God, now they know about me watching Human Centipede. And I bring that up because that is the knee-jerk reaction. And Valerie, you covered this, which is people have to get used to the fact that in big data, they really don't care what the individual person is doing. They're looking at patterns. They're looking for that relevancy. And the relevancy isn't going to be found in that one person in the chat room watched an incredibly disgusting movie with absolutely no merit that should probably be taken off of Netflix, thrown into space, and detonated with a fusion bomb. But the fact that there are patterns of viewership that drive certain decisions. What's your take on user privacy and what people should be worried about?
Go ahead.
We'll come back to you, Val. Brian, go first, and we'll come back.
One of the things that Netflix does that sometimes is a hit, sometimes is a miss, is I like them coming up and saying, you viewed these movies, you might like this one. What do you think? Sometimes they've pointed out some movies that I didn't know existed. Sometimes they didn't, and I'm looking really bad. What happened to my link? Am I still there?
You're still there.
Okay, sorry. So, I don't know. It's kind of along the lines of, I don't think it's creepy. I think it works nicely. I think I like the timely information. I draw an analogy back when telephony really started going crazy, and when you called up, the operator would say, "Oh, hi, Mr. Chi. How are you today? How's the weather in Hawaii?" That was a little creepy, but they've changed that. So now it's like, "Hi, Mr. Chi. What can we do to help you?" And, "Oh, we see that it's your house insurance is just about up. Would you like a liability review or something like that?" That just felt a little less creepy because then they're giving me more targeted information and it's more timely. And they're not just saying, "Oh, we know where you are."
Right. Valerie, I want to go over to you because something that Chibert brought up is how do we make this less creepy? I think the real question is, and it's the brass tacks question, how do you, a business owner, an enterprise owner, implement big data in your business? How do you do it properly so that it's beneficial, it's relevant, without being creepy? Let's go there.
Sure. So the first thing is, and this is the beautiful thing about mobile that's different than the web, which is that with mobile, it's all about the opt-in, right? So the first thing you should do as an enterprise or a brand is allow your users to opt in. And I think that that's a very important thing. And right now, when you're on the web, you don't really get all those opportunities. They're cooking you and they're following you where you go and what you're doing and all of that. In the mobile world, it's all about the opt-in. That's number one. Number two is understand what your user is doing. Like, look at the big data to understand those trends. And again, not just at the individual level, but at bucketing these people together, because you're going to start to see trends emerge in terms of how they're yet leveraging your brand, how they're leveraging the mobile app or the mobile website that you've created. And then talk to them in the way that is relative to their behaviors with your brand. So, right now, one of the ways that people leverage big data or they're not leveraging big data enough, but they're doing a lot of what they think is engagement. So once somebody downloads a mobile app, they're blasting out all these push messages that say, "Hey, we've got 20% off today on belts or 30% off tomorrow on shoes," all of this stuff. Well, they're just broadcasting in it. It's basically the old days of email where it's spam, 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 spam. If you really want to build trust with your users and trust with your customers, what you need to do is talk to them when they want to be talked to about the things that they want to be talked to about. And so really look closely at the data to see which trends are emerging, which types of audience segments you may have, not the ones necessarily that you think you should have, and I can talk about that in a second, but the ones that are emerging based on the behaviors of the usage pattern of people in your site, and then talk to them. So yeah, do a push notification, but do a push notification that's relevant to them at that moment, at that time, when they are going to be most receptive to it. And the big data will tell you that. It's all there.
Let me interrupt you for a second and just go over to Chibert. Chibert, listening to what Val has said about how we make it less creepy, by how we make it relevant, again, putting on your user hat, your simple user hat with your mobile phone, would you find it to be an acceptable trade-off to have all this information being collected and processed about you, if then you could give people relevant, targeted ads rather than the spam approach that has been so traditional?
Yeah, as a user, I think I wouldn't mind that. You know, I like the example of walking into a Starbucks and, you know, and an ad pops up saying, if I buy a cup of coffee, I'll say, get a free biscotti, or I'll get a free shot of syrup or something like that. I think that'd be kind of cool, actually. Starbucks, are you listening? Hint, yeah. Hint.
They do it. Get the Starbucks app. I mean,
I do literally have the Starbucks app, but it's always late.
Yeah.
I get better stuff off Foursquare.
Yes, absolutely. Foursquare does a great job of location-based targets and, you know, based on where you are in that city block and what things are around you that you could leverage. They're a classic example of leveraging big data in a smart way.
All right, Val, back into it. So you were completing the non-creepy big data business plan. We started with the relevance. Where else do we go?
Well, I think, you know, I'll give a specific example in a case study of a customer of ours that, what they do is they have an expectant parents app, right? So if you're a woman who's either trying to get pregnant, about to get pregnant, or is pregnant, you download this app, and then through a series of opt-ins and information that you provide, they then start to send you messaging around the stage of...
Oh, she was just about to reveal the secrets of big data.
Did you lose me?
Yeah. So back up. You were just about to tell us what the secret was, and Skype froze up on you.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Well, there you have it. And I have to go now. So thank you very much.
No, I'm kidding.
No. That's a joke.
I thought it was just a dramatic pause. You were sort of trying to make us want it more.
So
tell us again.
So I'm giving an example of a particular customer of ours that has a pregnancy app that for expectant mothers, and basically through a series of opt-ins and information that the user gives to this particular app, it will tell you which stage of your pregnancy you're at, okay? And how this particular customer leveraged big data is that their brand was all about being folksy, right? They were, your little bump is this far along, and, you know, see what's going to happen next with your bump. And they thought that because that was tied into their brand, that that type of messaging and that type of engagement would drive more usage of their app. And what they found by leveraging the big data and doing a series of testing around that, some A/B multivariate testing, they actually found out that that folksy messaging and that folksy brand image wasn't working for them, as well as being more clinical. So through a variety of looking at the big data first, understanding what that baseline defensible metric was for how people were interacting with their app, then doing a series of testing around their app with both push notifications and in-app messaging and then other app features, they were able to then identify that they had better success by going towards a more clinical tone and more clinical offering and being more factual, less folksy with how they were presenting their information and their content in their app. So that was a really good use of leveraging that big data. And they were able to improve their open rates of their app by over 300%. And when you're talking about something that's ad supported, which this app is, that's how they make their revenue, a 300% increase in open rates, in engagement rates, is a game changer for them, an absolute game changer. And what they found is that they had happier customers because they were being talked to in a way that was interesting to them and made them look at the information, gather the information that the app was promoting, and then be able to really make not only decisions around it, but understand where they were in the stage of their pregnancy.
What I like about that is you're talking about the feedback component of big data. I think when big data is abused is when someone takes data sets and just using those data sets, they make certain decisions that set them down a particular path and they never look back. What you're talking about is taking big data, using it, and then evaluating how that use occurs, whether or not you are actually giving people more relevant targeted ads, whether or not you're actually addressing them in a way that they prefer. Is that one of the things that you think more people should do in their use of big data? You know, take that step of building in a measurable analysis of what happened when they used their data.
Absolutely. In fact, I think that you're doing your audience and your customer a disservice if you don't do that. And you would be very surprised how many marketers and brands are out there that they pat themselves on the back and they say, I made an app. Congratulations to me. You know, I have a million installs of my app. Woo, let's do a victory dance. You're going to see that 2013 is all about big data, all about engagement. People are going to start to go away from this installs, you know, this install metric, and they're going to start to really be looking at engagement and retention and conversion metrics. And that's what big data is going to be able to tell you. You know, there's a lot of tried and true methods out there to acquire that install. But really, there needs to be a more disciplined approach towards that engagement, retention, and conversion layer, and leveraging big data to help you do that in the most effective way. And your customers are going to trust you more, they're going to believe in you more, and they're going to be more loyal because you are talking to them again in a highly relevant manner, right time, right place, right language, based on your behaviors.
Jared, let me break over to you for a second. And again, take off the user hat and put back on your IT administrator hat. This all sounds good. I mean, it's good to have relevant targeting. It's good to have a feedback structure that allows you to look at engagement rather than just simple app installations or app opens. But from an IT perspective, from an enterprise perspective, you're talking about things that are not necessarily measurable in the ways that we would typically measure them, right? I mean, there is no really good way to measure engagement other than someone who has experience with engagement actually evaluating what you're doing.
Yeah, except this question really isn't an IT question. This question is more of a marketing question. Marketing people go through these kinds of statistics. Now, I want to actually take this conversation in a slight tangent. While we're all talking about this, it occurs to me that big data might also have a really, really relevant role in the K-12 world, or maybe not K-12, maybe 6-12. As the children start becoming young adults, one of the lessons that isn't being taught and a lot of people aren't teaching is, you know, your life is on Facebook and Twitter. Be careful what you stick up there. Maybe big data can be used as, let's go and monitor things. You know, what are the kids doing? Obviously, we have to have an opt-in with the parents so we can figure out what the heck is going on with these kids. If they're having troubles, if they're having bullying problems, can the school respond to it? I think the subliminal message here is let the school or let the school district watch what's going on and be intrusive once in a while to make sure that these kids understand that this stuff is really public. But at the same time, maybe we can avoid having some of these kids coming to school with guns and shooting everybody up. It's a very controversial view, but what do you think?
Okay, I like that. So we're taking big data lessons of give me one more word, Valerie, because we've got relevance, we've got engagement. What would you think a third part is there?
I think just application, right?
Okay, so, relevance, data, application. You know,
yeah, I would go back to like what Brian's saying, and you can leverage this big data in many, many ways, right? And I think it's then applying it. So really analyzing what the data is telling you and then applying it not just towards marketing. I agree with Brian that this does have more of that application towards marketing, but applying it towards your product itself, right? So it's not just about how to market and that engagement and the retention, but it can help define your product development requirements in your roadmap, right? So really looking at that data and the behaviors, you know, Netflix isn't going to suddenly go about now. You know, they're looking at this big data as well to define what they should be doing next with their business and with their product. And now what did they come up with? Original content, right? So that's a classic example of leveraging that big data to not only, you know, come up with a new arena for them to expand their business into. And do it in a smart way. And I think that, as Brian's saying, for education, the applications of this are endless for educators. And, you know, you're seeing more and more schools that are starting to give kids iPads. You know, there are private schools all over the Bay Area here. My kids go to public schools, so they're not beneficiaries of this. But private schools here in the San Francisco Bay Area now are giving iPads to every single student to take home. And to Brian's point, you know, you can really track what they're doing on that and then understand, you know, are they at risk? Are they, you know, not only are they at risk academically, but also socially. And I think that, you know, parents are understanding there's heavy amounts of opt-in for that. And really being able to leverage that if you're a smart educator in a way to apply it. So that application of it, not application meaning app, but application of leveraging that big data to apply it towards your business strategy.
I want to do one last round just to talk about briefly what we've discussed in big data. Chibrit, I want to start with you. Looking at the issues that we brought up about big data, about its usage, about its importance, about the options that it opens up both for marketing and for IT, what would you say is the five-year prognosis? Where would you expect to see these big data principles being applied, be it schools or small businesses, home businesses, enterprise? What do you want to see in 5 years?
Well, it's not so much what I want to see, because a lot of the kids that are coming out of school now, I'm an old fart. But the reality is the world is changing. I'm used to having things like telephone desk sets. I'm used to having a telephone on my desk. The kids that are graduating now, they don't care. They'd rather have it on their mobile device. The world is changing. Same thing goes with how their actions on the internet are looked at, you know, the harvesting of the big data. They've grown up with this. So just like TV commercials, as we start getting more and more risque, you know, we're getting Victoria's Secret ads on regular broadcast TV now. 10 years ago, that would have been censored. So as society changes, I think our answer to that question needs to change with it. And you know, that's why a lot of kids need to get up and vote, because that's really how things change. You know, as they are willing to make their voice heard through voting and through buying, that's how a lot of the general public gets to vote.
Mm-hmm. Right. And Valerie, I want to give it over to you. Slightly different question. If I was running a small to medium business, or even a large enterprise, what would you say is the Cliff's Note version of your recommendations for how I use big data? And you can incorporate all the things you've talked about opting in, about relevance, about engagement. What are the steps that I absolutely must take, or else I risk seeing my big data endeavor die?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, you can make better business decisions and understand your customers better by leveraging the big data. And I think that it's very important to do that. And I think, you know, let's bring it down to mobile in specific, which is that I think that a lot of big enterprises and small businesses are used to leveraging data and analytics for their web endeavors, but they're not used to doing that for mobile. Mobile is still a little bit back in like 2000, 2001. Right? And it's very quickly, in fact, I would say within the next 12 to 18 months, people, you know, you would be surprised at how many enterprises, small businesses, and retailers, all they know about their mobile app or their mobile web is how many people came that day. It's the old, remember when we used to say, how many hits did you get to your website? It's very similar now with mobile. And I think that what you're going to find is that same discipline and approach that is applied towards the web via the desktop will now be applied towards the mobile device. But mobile in big data is going to be able to give you so much more. It's going to be much more granular data, a better opportunity to segment, better opportunity to understand from a behavioral perspective what your customers are doing, and really take that and, you know, leverage all of those tools that you've been using as an enterprise and as a business and as an IT shop or a marketer for the past 15 years and apply that towards mobile and big data. And so really, you know, understanding, going back in, you know, understanding what your customers are looking for, starting with that opt-in, and then once they're opted in, really understanding based on the behaviors that they're doing to be able to give them the right product at the right time with the right message.
Chibert, Valerie, thank you very much for an absolutely stimulating edition of TWiET. Unfortunately, we have reached the end of our hour. Now, there are a few things I want to remind our audience out there. And the first thing is that, well, did you know that we do this show live? That's right. We broadcast it live every Monday noon Pacific time. You can go to live.twit.tv to watch the stream. And while you're there, why not participate in our chat room at irc.twit.tv? You'll find out that TWiET isn't just a network. We are an experiment in temporary community. And in that chat room, as you heard throughout this broadcast, I will occasionally take comments. I will take questions and I will introduce you to some of the most brilliant engineers and the greatest trolls on the face of the planet. Also, you can subscribe to TWiET. That's right. You can have all the TWiET goodness downloaded into your favorite device each and every week. Go to the TWiET page at twit.tv/TWiET, and you'll be able to find all the different ways that you can have each episode delivered to you. You want high-definition video? Sure. You want high-definition audio? Of course. Pretty much every format, every device. You want it on your iPad? We got you. You want it on your iPhone? Sure. You want it on your Android device? You betcha. Even your Zoom. That's right, for people who are really, really into zombies. Furthermore, you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you follow me, you'll be able to find out what we're doing each week on TWiET. And as my followers have figured out, you'll be able to ask me for specific topics that we will cover on future episodes. You'll also be able to find out what the Digital Jesuit does in between tapings of the best enterprise show in the whole dang world. Finally, go to our YouTube page at youtube.com/TWiET. It's a new thing. We're trying to separate out the different Twitch shows so that we can give each one a form. And I believe that it's a week and a half from now, we're going to be having our first Google Hangout. So make sure that you subscribe so that you can find out where it's going to be and how you can participate. I want to thank my panelists. Thank you very much. Brian, what's going on in Hawaii? What do you want our audience to know about?
I think I just want our audience to know that there are ramifications to how you use data. I think with, you know, great powers come great responsibility. You know, that's an old saying from, you know, the cartoons. But you've got an awful lot of data that's coming into you. Use it wisely, and maybe, just maybe, your audience will respond to it.
And Valerie, what's going on with you? What do you want our audience to know about? Are there any special projects that they should be aware of?
No, I just would encourage everybody that if you are really interested in harnessing, you know, big data for mobile messaging and creating an intelligence layer around that, to please check out www.otherlevels.com or follow us at Other Levels on Twitter. But you'll be able to find out about what we do with that mobile messaging layer and how we help our customers and our partners leverage big data for the mobile messaging layer. We do it with A/B message testing, measurement and deep analytics, targeting, retargeting, and also through audience segmentation. It's a very, very vibrant platform that we have, and we're working with some of the top retailers in the country as well as some of the biggest gaming, mobile gaming brands in the world. So I really encourage you to check us out at otherlevels.com. And if you're interested, then look for me.
And thank you. Thank you for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. And you know we're going to have you back at some point, hopefully in the studio where we can get some high-definition audio and video to talk more about big data. I also want to thank everyone who made I also want to talk about everyone who made this show possible. Everyone from our super TD, Mr. Jason Owl, who never shines a camera on himself because, you know, he's cool like that, to Karsten. Oh, thank you, Jason. To Karsten, our super producer, who, puts everything together, especially when I'm not in the Brick House, and to everyone else at the Brick House who makes the show run smoothly. I thank you from the bottom of my heart. Now, I actually do want to take a little bit of time at the end of the show. Some of you may know this, but, you know, I think it's worth noting. we think of Twit as not a, just a network, as I mentioned before, but it is a temporary community. There's a lot of people who have been in this chat room, who have been talking back and forth, who have been participating in the Twit experiment for years and years and years. And for many of us, that goes back even further. It reaches into other networks. It sort of transcends what we're watching, and it gets into what we love, what we're passionate about. And we're passionate about technology. We're passionate about being geeks. And that's why I was incredibly saddened this weekend when I heard about the passing of one of ChatRealm's own. He goes by the name of Steven3x. His name was actually Lawrence E. Brooks. Lived not too far away from me here in D.C. And I learned, thanks to Dan and to Keith512 in the chat room, that, he actually passed away last May. Had some sort of complication in the hospital, and, he died. Steven was a big part of the Twit chat room. If you were in the chat room during those times that he was active, you knew he was there. He was always quick with a joke. I had many good conversations with him in private messaging, both here and in the Buzz Out Loud chat room. He was a true geek, and, he will be missed. One of the things that we try to do is we try to make people feel at home, and Steven3x was a big part of that. So I just wanted to take a moment to thank him for everything that he did for us and to give my thoughts and my prayers and the love of the chat room to Steven3x. I'm Father Robert Ballester. This is Twit. And remember, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep Twit.